Welcome to Shortwave, a PBS NewsHour podcast talking about foreign events that have an impact close to home. I'm NewsHour foreign affairs and defense reporter-producer PJ Tobia. Imagine if you woke up one day and all of the working-age men and women in your town were gone. They disappeared practically overnight. How would that change your culture and lifestyle? Now, imagine that everybody is back in your town, but all of the commerce has disappeared. There are no stores, no offices, no places to work. How would that change your culture and lifestyle? Well, that first scenario, the one where everybody disappears, is exactly what happened in towns all across Mexico. Meanwhile, that second scenario, where entire towns go out of business, was playing out in communities all across the central United States. The crazy part? Both things happened for the exact same reason. This is the story of what happened when the U.S. stepped away from making things on a big industrial scale. We still do it, but not nearly as much as we used to. It's also about how that manufacturing moved south to Mexico, where factories hum day and night.
They're making flat-screen TVs, women's intimate apparel, lawn equipment, medical equipment. The list goes on and on and on. They publish books there, even for American consumers, almost exclusively.
That's Chad Broughton. I spoke with him on the phone. He's a sociologist who spent 12 years studying the phenomenon of the disappearance of American manufacturing and its reappearance south of the Rio Grande.
20 million hours each month put in by workers in Reynosa in these factories. 20 million hours.
The way he describes the factories in his new book, Boom Bust Exodus, really surprised me.
We went down in 2003 expecting, you know, the sweatshop that you hear about, but it was ultra modern, but the work is completely de-skilled. Any skill requirements had been taken out of the work to be made into the kind of work that somebody could learn in a matter of minutes, really.
So they're clean, modern, gleaming factories, unlike the aging Rust Belt factories they replaced in the U.S., but they can be very dangerous.
People are exploited. There's sexual harassment. There are dangerous chemicals. Overtime that's not compensated for adequately. There's a long list of grievances that you get anywhere where people work, but there's just not an adequate system for addressing those grievances.
In addition to being physically dangerous, there's no other kinds of protections for people there.
We don't have anybody kind of looking out for the worker or amplifying their voices.
So there's no unions, there's no labor board to take grievances to, and if you're hurt, there's no workers' compensation that they can take advantage of. So why do it? Why are Mexicans abandoning their farms in droves in the interior of the country to go to the north, to towns like Reynosa, where Chad Broughton visited, to work in these factories called maquiladoras?
They hear about the steady work from their families, from their friends, you know, 48 hours a week, maybe 60 hours a week, you know, some overtime. And they think, wow, that's the place for me and my family. But when they get here, they realize that it pays about the same per hour as back in the rural areas, and the cost of living is much higher.
Here's the crazy part. Broughton spent years studying this, spent a lot of time in Mexico, and he says the people he spoke to, even the ones who had gotten deathly ill from working in the factories, said it was worth it.
People that had gotten cancer from working at a maquiladora would still say, we're glad the jobs are here. We need to work. We just wish that they would treat us differently.
And you know, if a job like that in a factory will lift you and, more importantly, your children and their children out of endemic poverty, the kind of rural poverty that places like Mexico see, then it would be worth it. Except, says Broughton,
it doesn't really allow at least the generation that works there now a toehold in the middle class. They're still very poor. Their purchasing power in Reynosa is low.
And more than just physical harm or economic stagnation, there's a bigger kind of disruption that's happening in Mexican society because of these factories on the northern border. It's a kind of national crazy-making, if you will. Broughton sums it up like this.
Sociologists have a term for this, social disorganization. It means that things are chaotic, people don't really trust their neighbors so much, and that's a big change from the rural areas that they've come from. So many folks get stuck at the border, and many others take the risk and go across the border for a $6, $7, $8 an hour job instead of a $1.50 job.
So in addition to the pull factor of these factories in the north of Mexico, drawing people, pulling them off of their land, there's also a push factor.
The Mexican government has given up to a large degree on the small-scale farmer. There's a new emerging in the 1980s, a new way of thinking about agriculture that emphasized large-scale farming, efficiencies of scale, and seeing subsidies to poor farmers as just a way to keep them poor. A lot of the people who kind of shifted Mexico in this direction in the 80s and 90s were trained in economic departments in the United States. And so they bought into this Washington consensus, as it's sometimes called, between the World Bank, the U.S. Treasury, and the IMF, which saw that there, you know, this particular kind of market-oriented way to reform these countries that includes austerity for rural areas.
Basically, according to Broughton, Mexicans with American MBAs decided that small-scale farming was a bad thing to base a big part of the Mexican economy on. So policies were formulated by the Mexican government to discourage that kind of economic activity. As a result, a lot of people left their farms.
As you see in, say, northern Veracruz, towns that are, you know, almost the entire working age population is gone, and just like children and older folks are left. You know, half the population literally is gone.
This is what I meant at the start of the episode when I talked about entire working age populations disappearing overnight. Meanwhile, north of the border, in Midwest factory towns, people woke up and something else was missing. Much of the commerce and employment opportunities were gone or had scaled back dramatically.
We lost 5.8 million manufacturing jobs in the 2000s, and a much bigger decline than any other time in our history. And that really had an enormous effect in hollowing out the American lower middle class.
We should back up here. Long before Chad Broughton went to Mexico to take a look at the maquiladoras, his research began in the early 2000s in a town called Galesburg, Illinois. Galesburg was home to a massive factory that had been pumping out all kinds of manufactured goods for over 100 years for companies like Admiral, Magic Chef, and finally Maytag. This factory was huge, 2.25 million square feet, about the size of 21 Walmarts squeezed together. At its heyday, it employed around 5,000 people. That was in the 70s, and became known as Appliance City. Appliance City meant solid union jobs that paid as much as $75,000 a year for people with little more than a high school diploma, if that. It employed generations of workers, literally generations, grandfathers, fathers, sons, eventually daughters. Entire families worked on the line at Appliance City at one time or another. For most of its final decades of existence, Appliance City was owned by the Maytag Corporation. Maytag was a quintessentially American business. It was never the largest maker of home appliances. Its brand was quality. Remember the Maytag repairman?
You know, that's the trouble with you Maytag washers and dryers. You're too dependable. It's not often that anybody needs us Maytag repairmen. That's why we're the loneliest guys in town.
Like the Appliance City factory, Maytag had deep roots in rural Illinois, going back almost 100 years. But in 2004, Maytag closed the plant and moved it to Mexico. Mike Patrick is in his 70s. He spent 46 years at the plant. In 2014, he was interviewed by a local TV news station at the 10-year anniversary of its closing.
You know, for so many years, I've walked through them gates and stuff, knowing that it was ending. It was sad. It was sad.
Broughton spent years with the former Appliance City workers who were hit hard by the plant's closing. People like Jackie and Shannon Cummings.
They had gone from earning $76,000 at the factory in today's dollars to $37,000 today. Jackie works in a hospital, low wage, near minimum wage. Shannon works in a school near minimum wage.
So most of the laid-off workers barely had high school diplomas and could never dream of coming close to earning that kind of money again. Some might never re-enter the job market at all. But meanwhile, down in Reynosa, a whole lot of people were about to enter full-time factory work for the first time and for the Maytag company, but just on very different terms because the factory reopened in Reynosa. And if Maytag's relationship with Galesburg was kind of like a marriage between high school sweethearts, its dalliance with Reynosa was a lot more like a one-night stand or a casual hookup.
So there's not really a commitment on either side between the management or labor to a long-term relationship, if you know what I mean. Like, the managers can get a new worker at any time, and workers can really go to somewhere else in Reynosa and get a job at any time. And so the kind of relationship that you had in Galesburg, where workers, in fact, generations of workers would work at that appliance factory in Galesburg, you have here workers working for a very short period of time.
And also, the money that Maytag spends in Reynosa on wages and taxes, a lot of it doesn't stay in Reynosa.
Doesn't do much for the local economy. It just, you know, the dollars come in for these very low wages, and then they get spent by the workers in these large Costco-owned, Walmart-owned retail outlets, low-end retail outlets on the outskirts of town where these migrant workers live, and that money then leaves the local economy. Local suppliers haven't really grown up. Local machine shops and the kind of stuff that you used to see associated with factories in the United States and the Rust Belt haven't really grown up.
Despite a lack of investment or infrastructure in Mexico's new industrial boom towns like Reynosa, people kept coming, and they kept emptying out the rural villages in the interior. But in towns like Galesburg, when the factory closed, people stayed put.
People stuck it out in their rural communities. So Galesburg has not seen a big decline in its population. People are getting by on less, sometimes half of their former factory income, sometimes maybe 80%. You know, I talk to workers who say, you know, I ask them, well, why don't you go to St. Louis or Chicago?
Going back to the example of Jackie and Shannon, they didn't go very far at all after being laid off.
They moved around a little bit, Quad Cities for a little while and so on. Did some extreme commuting to a Walmart distribution center for a while, but then they ended up close to home because they just said, well, we're just farm girls at heart, and I'm close to my family, and my family takes care of my kids when I go to work. I don't see how it would be much better if I had to pay, you know, five times as much for housing or more in a place like Chicago.
My main street's whitewashed windows and vacant stores. Seems like there ain't nobody wants to come down here no more. They're closing down the textile mill across the railroad tracks. Mormon says these jobs are going, boys, and they ain't coming back to your hometown.
So that's the story of how the same economic forces changed the faces of towns in both the U.S. and Mexico. They're powerful forces, beyond any single individual's control. We're all influenced by them, but we also help create them. After all, we buy the products. It's really all about stuff for me and you and my neighbors to buy. And I just wonder, how are we implicated in this? And by we, I mean Americans more generally, people who are far removed from the people who are creating all of these things that we buy.
I think this is important, and one of the reasons why I wrote the book is to look at those interrelationships, those transnational interrelationships. And if you think about it, Reynosa, Tamaulipas is as much an American creation as it is a Mexican creation, yet it remains an invisible city in many ways.
That's it for this episode. You can find out more about Broughton's book and listen to the previous episode of Shortwave at our website, newshour.org. Shortwave is a production of PBS NewsHour. Sarah Just, executive producer. Justin Kenny is NewsHour's senior producer for foreign affairs and defense. Travis Dobb is creative director. Vanessa Dennis created the graphics for Shortwave. The theme music was composed by Jeremy Gibson. Sound patterns by Satuniman. Jenny Martyr edits Shortwave's online content. Natalie Boyd offered production assistance. Special thanks for editorial oversight and inspiration to Hari Srinivasan. I'm your host and producer, PJ Tobia. I hope you'll join us next time for Shortwave.